considered this, then said, "What makes you think I don't have a few?" His daughter didn't answer right away. "It's not like you don't have any," she explained, for once leaving her fork at rest. "It's just that everybody figures them out." "I think you're just repeating what your mother always says about me."
"I'm repeating what everybody says about you because it's true. I'm more like Mom," she added somberly, as if this were something she wasn't particularly proud of.
Since he and Janine had filed for divorce, Tick had begun cataloging her differences and similarities to each of her parents, perhaps thinking this genetic roadmap might make her own destiny more navigable. "I'll be good at keeping secrets. If I cheated on my husband, nobody would ever know." Miles opened his mouth, then shut it again, wondering, as he often did, if there was another 16-year-old like this one anywhere else in the world. "Tick," he finally said.
"I didn't say I'd cheat on my husband," she added. "I just said I can keep a secret."
Before Miles could respond, the bell above the front door tinkled, and Janine materialized in the doorway as if summoned by her daughter's illusion. Without pausing for a moment, she headed right for them through the crowded restaurant. Tick, also without turning around in the booth, seemed to know that her mother had appeared, and she slid over next to the window to make room.
"We weren't expecting you for another hour, at least," Miles said, when Janine slid into the booth, pulled her sweatshirt over her head, and revealed a hot pink exercise leotard underneath.
"Yeah, well, here I am anyway," she said. "And don't be staring at my breasts, Miles. We were married for 20 years, and they never interested you that whole time." Miles felt himself color, because he had been staring at them.
"That's not true," he said weakly.
Actually, he wasn't really all that interested in them now, except for the fact that they were so completely on display beneath her leotard, though this wasn't a subject he was keen on pursuing in front of their daughter.
"I just finished up at the club," Janine explained, "and I'm hot and sweaty, and I haven't even had a chance to shower."
She turned toward Tick. "You ready to go home?"
"I guess," Tick said.
"You guess," Janine repeated.
"Is there somebody who'd know for sure? Somebody we could consult for a definitive answer?"
"I have to get my backpack," Tick told her.
"You don't have to be such a bitch every minute, do you?"
"Yes, I do, little girl," Janine said, sliding out of the booth so Tick could get out. "You'll understand why when you're 40.
"You're 41, Tick reminded her. 42 this January.
Miles watched his daughter all the way into the back room, feeling, as he always did these days, a terrible mix of irreconcilable emotions. The shame of his failed marriage, anger at Janine for her part in its dissolution, anger at himself for his own part, and gratitude that they'd managed to be faithful to a bad idea long enough to have this child. He would have liked to know if Janine felt any of this, or whether she'd managed to simplify her emotional life by indulging only the regret. Turning back to Janine, Miles caught her sneaking a scallop off Tick's plate.
"Damn," she said, aware that she'd been witnessed. "Damn, that's good."
"I could order you some, Janine," Miles offered. "It wouldn't kill you to eat something."
"That's where you're mistaken, Miles. That's exactly what it would do. I'm not going to be fat again. Not ever."
Charlene happened to be passing by at that moment, so Janine handed her the plate.
"Do me a favor and get this away from me, will you?" she said, then turned back to Miles.
"There's a word for people like you," she continued.
"Enabler."
There was a word for people like Janine, too, Miles thought, and her own daughter had already applied it. "You're through feeding me, buddy boy. I've assumed control of my own body."
"Good," Miles said. "I'm happy for you."
If Janine heard any sarcasm in this, she didn't react to it. In fact, some of her anger seemed to leak away. And when Tick reappeared with her backpack, Janine said,
"Why don't you go on out to the car for a couple minutes? Since I'm here, I want to talk to your father."
Tick leaned into the booth to give Miles a kiss.
"See you tomorrow, Daddy. Will you have time to proof a paper?"
"I'll make time," Miles said. "It wasn't very nice to fool me about eating your dinner, though."
"I know,"
she said without the slightest indication of remorse.
You're just so easy.
Once she was safely through the door, Miles turned back to Janine. You sure are tough on her lately. He knew as soon as he spoke the words that they were a mistake. For Miles, one of the great mysteries of marriage was that you had to actually say things before you realized they were wrong. Because he'd been saying the wrong thing to Janine for so many years, he'd grown wary, testing most of his observations in the arena of his imagination before saying them out loud. But even then, he was often wrong. Of course, the other possibility was that there was no right thing to say, that the choice wasn't between right and wrong, but between wrong, more wrong, and as wrong as you can get. Wrong, all of it, to one degree or another, by definition or by virtue of the fact that Miles himself was the one saying it. Well, somebody has to be, Janine said, her hackles now as fully raised as her nipples, since she can do no wrong with either her father or her uncle. Miles opened his mouth to object, but his wife, no surprise, wasn't finished. Walt's no better either. The worse she treats him, the more he fawns over her. She's just a kid, Janine. Ours. Janine picked up an unused spoon, held it like a knife at her temple, and made as if to drive it home. Miles, you're wrong. First, she's not a kid. You don't believe me? Just look at her. Try using the eyes you look at other people with. Second, so what? I was never a kid, and neither were you. From the time I was old enough to manage it, I was changing my brother's and sister's diapers. Tix led a charm life, and you know it. Wasn't that the idea? Miles said. I thought that's what we meant to do. Not forever, Miles. What Miles was imagining right now was their daughter watching them, their heads bent forward toward the center of the table so they could lower their voices and still yell at each other. No, this last year of their daughter's life had been anything but charmed. Maybe the others hadn't been so wonderful either. Janine, he said, feeling suddenly exhausted, could we not fight? Nope, that's what the last 20 years have been about, in case you missed it. Also, every time there's a problem and the damn school calls somebody, they don't call you, they call me. I'm the one who has to leave work to deal with it, not you. I'm not sure that's fair, Miles said. I wish they would call me. If you'd let me have primary custody. Right. And where would she live, upstairs? Move the pallets of fryolator grease down to the basement to make a little room for her? You have a point. Miles said, trying to keep the bitterness out of his voice. I am left without a house in all this, speaking of which. Don't, Janine pointed the spoon at him. Don't go there. Okay, he agreed, since he'd already gone there and Janine knew it. Janine had promised to talk to Walt about the house. The sensible, fair thing, she agreed, would be for Walt to buy out Miles' share, or what would have been his share if he had one. The settlement would award Janine the house, and Miles had been instructed to continue paying half of the mortgage until such time as the property sold or she remarried. Privately, he and Janine had agreed that when the house did sell, they would divide what was left of the equity. The money they'd used for a down payment had been his, but it didn't amount to that much, and he decided not to make an issue of it, or anything else. His instructions to his lawyer had been simple. Let her have what she wants. In truth, there was embarrassingly little to quibble over, and even if he'd felt like it, he couldn't be small with Janine without being small with Tick. Not an option. However, the divorce would soon be final, allowing for Janine's long postponed nuptials, and Miles was beginning to wonder if he should have listened to his lawyer's advice. Walt Como, the lawyer had correctly predicted, would rent his own house and move in with Janine. Is that what you want? For the man who stole your wife to live with her in your house, sleeping in your bed, all of it rent-free? Well, of course, Miles hadn't wanted that, but at the time such a scenario seemed far-fetched. What sort of man would behave that way? But then Miles wouldn't have predicted that Walt Como would also become a regular at the grill, dropping in every afternoon to drink coffee and play gin with Horace and offer Miles business tips. Just today, he'd suggested that Miles add an E to the word grill,
to make the place sound classier. Every time Walt made one of his proposals, two things occurred to Miles. First, strange as it seemed, was that Walt's purpose was not to inspire Miles to homicide. Walt Como truly believed his suggestions to be valuable. And second, he was probably offering them in lieu of rent. Most people, Miles had come to understand, went about their business logically enough if you granted them a couple fundamental assumptions. No court had ordered Walt to pay rent on Miles's house, so he wouldn't. Still, he couldn't help but feel sorry for the man whose wife he'd stolen. Fair and square, Walt would consider it, the better man having won. And so, even without obligation to do so, he would continue to look for little opportunities to make it up to Miles. In fact, he seemed increasingly determined to help out in any way he could. No doubt he thought his free advice was worth thousands of dollars, yet Miles stubbornly refused to implement any of it. What could you do? Talk about leading a horse to water. No. If Miles were to die in his sleep tonight, Walt would tell every last mourner that he'd tried everything he could think of to turn the Empire Grill into a profitable enterprise. Miles was a hell of a nice guy, he would conclude, but he had no head for business. Nothing about any of this would strike the Silver Fox as outrageous. I did speak to him about it, Janine finally said, staring at a reflection in the window. He said... Here she paused again, as if she herself could hardly credit what she was about to report. He said he's not sure that real estate here is that good an investment right now. Really? Miles said. He figured that out? He says he doesn't want to tie up his money until he's sure about his next move. When will that be? I don't know, Miles. I really don't, she admitted, suddenly dropping the pretense of being angry. Have you ever noticed the way he scratches his chin when he plays cards? When he tries to figure out what Horace is holding? It's almost like time stops, like you're watching a still life. Janine, I mean, who knows? One minute he's talking about expanding the club, putting in indoor tennis courts. Then the next he's saying we should build a place out by the lake. There's a half acre of waterfront property he's had his eye on. But when I ask him where exactly, he gets all secretive, like I'm going to blab to somebody who'll buy it out from under him. Every time I try to pin him down about anything, he gets that sly expression, you know, the one he always gets right before Horace gins him. Janine. She continued staring at her reflection, as if meeting his eye would amount to some terrible admission. When she finally did, there were tears. And it occurred to Miles that there might be something she wasn't telling him, something she wasn't sure of herself. What, Miles? Are you having second thoughts? She wiped the corner of one eye with the strap of her leotard and gathered her defiance again, causing Miles to wonder, as he had on and off for 2 decades, what there was about this combative stance that Janine found so attractive. No, don't worry. She assured him. I'm going through with it, I promise. This time next month, all you'll owe is child support. I never said I wanted you to go through with anything, Miles reminded her, suddenly feeling the kind of tenderness toward his ex-wife that occasionally crept up on him when he wasn't paying strict attention. It's not Walt and me I'm worried about. What I still don't even begin to understand is us. You mean how we managed to make such a mess of everything? Janine made a face at him. Hell no, Miles. That part's easy. We messed things up because we didn't love each other. What I'd like to know is why. I mean, I told you why I didn't love you. Everything you did during the last 20 years that pissed me off, I told you about. Miles couldn't help but smile. True, Janine's list of his shortcomings was long, comprehensive, and subject to constant revision. Now here we are almost divorced, and I'm getting set to marry somebody else, and you still haven't told me why you didn't love me. Does that seem fair? I mean, if you were ever inclined to get married again, which I don't recommend, you'd at least know what to do different, right? Because I was honest with you. What do you want, Janine? A list of marital grievances? You took up with Walt Como, for God's sake. Well, sure, throw that in my face. Now it was Miles' turn to study his reflection in the glass. The man who stared back at him looked exasperated.
"It's not fair, and you know it," she continued. "I mean, sure, fine. I took up with Walt, so you've got a gripe. But I took up with Walt because you didn't love me. I know it hurt your feelings, me falling in love with him. But you shouldn't pretend you were in love with me, Miles, because we both know you weren't."
"What's my part in this conversation if you're going to speak for both of us?
Are you telling me you love me, Miles? If that's what you want to tell me, say it. I'll shut up so you can."
When he looked down at his hands, she said, "I didn't think so." She was right, of course. In the deepest sense, he hadn't loved her. Not the way he'd intended to. Not as he'd sworn he would before God and family and friends. And the simple truth embarrassed him too deeply to allow for anything like analysis. No, he hadn't loved her. And he didn't know why. He also didn't know what to call whatever it was that would have prevented him from telling her, even if he had known. If you didn't call it love, what did you call the kind of affection that makes you want to protect someone from hurt? What was the name of the feeling that threatened to swamp him now, that made him want to take her in his arms and tell her that everything would be all right? If not love, then what? Still, she was right. Because whatever it was he felt for this woman, whose life had been joined to his for so long, whatever it was certainly couldn't be confused with desire and need and yearning. Miles knew that much, if only because he'd tried his best to confuse them. "Why are you tormenting yourself, Janine?" he said. "If Walt makes you happy, what else matters?" She studied him for a minute, then gave up. "Beats the shit out of me," she admitted, forcing a smile. "I guess I'd just like to hear you say I'm not a horrible person."
"I never said you were a..."
"That's what I'm trying to tell you, Miles," she said, sliding out of the booth.
"You never said anything."
"He keeps saying he can climb like a monkey," Miles told his brother. They were upstairs in his apartment above the restaurant, and it was nearly 11 o'clock. Miles, a lifelong insomniac, would be awake by 5 anyway, but he couldn't help resenting that if he should ever be visited by a decent night's sleep, he'd have to interrupt it to open the restaurant. David, who'd taken a small club soda from the mini-fridge, set it down on the floor and moved a huge box of toilet paper off the sofa so he'd have a place to sit. The Sox were on TV, a late game from the West Coast. Janine had been right, of course. As things stood, there was no room for Tick here, even though he'd been toying with the idea earlier that evening, trying to make it work. He could move all the grill supplies back down into the basement until the river flooded again and the restaurant started taking on water. If he cleared out all that stuff, there would be room for both of them, except that a girl Tick's age needed more than space. She needed a room of her own with a door she could close, even slam, when necessary. Miles's apartment, which hadn't been occupied since Roger Sperry died, was basically one big room. Except for the door you entered by, there was only one other, to the bathroom. And even that didn't close tight. Tick deserved better. Sure, with a little work and expense, he could make it nicer, but it would still be a shabby second-floor flat above a place of business. For all of that, he knew that his daughter would jump at the chance to get out of her mother's house. She despised living under the same roof as Walt Como. Though it wasn't a whole lot bigger, the little cottage behind the bookstore on Martha's Vineyard would be plenty big for the two of them, if he could ever figure out how to afford it. "Everything he does," David remarked from the sofa, "he does like a monkey." Regarding their father, David was unsentimental. "You're right not to let him on any ladders, though. Don't let him con you into feeling sorry for him." "I'll try, but he's pretty good at getting to me. I guess I don't want to be sold short when I'm old," Miles said, trying to explain away the foolish emotion. Feeling sorry for Max Roby was certainly all of that. "Pretty good night," David said, shaking his longish hair. The effect of wearing a hairnet through an 8-hour shift was that you looked like you were still wearing one even after you took it off.
Better than pretty good, said Miles, who'd rung out the register. Looks like Thursdays might fly.
I'm not sure we've got our costs in line.
I doubt we're too far off.
You do know the next logical step, don't you?
Yes, I do, Miles said. This was an old conversation, pointless too, like so many of his conversations with his brother, going all the way back to when his mother was still alive.
Strange. He and David were closer now since his brother's crippling accident than ever. Before, both men had pushed their conversations until their words burst into flame, rekindling age-old resentments, reopening old wounds. There was nearly a decade's difference in their ages, and their life experiences were radically dissimilar. Miles had grown up before their mother became ill, David after. Perhaps just as important, they'd always been temperamental opposites. Miles careful and thoughtful, like their mother. David energetic and restless, like Max. Since the accident, though, all this seemed to matter less, though it troubled Miles that their newfound intimacy seemed to depend on their having so little to say to each other. They passed the baton of the restaurant back and forth with an almost effortless minimum of talk. Often their communication seemed almost ritualistic. David would report to Miles that he'd locked up, understanding that Miles already knew this, but also that he expected to hear these words, probably was waiting to hear them, needing them to provide some kind of closure that the day wouldn't otherwise have.
Wouldn't need to be a full liquor license, David said. Beer and wine would do it.
Mrs. Whiting won't go for it, though.
She'd rather lose money?
Odd, but Miles had the feeling this might be the precise, literal truth. It violated logic, of course. Why be content to squeak by on the slenderest of profit margins when there was an opportunity for more substantial gain? Mrs. Whiting was a practical and ruthless businesswoman who had recognized the exact moment at which to sell each of the three Whiting mills, who had never before exhibited the slightest patience with borderline businesses. Yet for more than a decade, she'd seemed content to let the Empire Grill limp along toward its inevitable extinction. In the absence of any other rational explanation, Miles had almost concluded that it must be a matter of affection. But for whom? Miles himself? It was possible, he supposed. Horace, as clever and cynical an observer as the local scene offered, had concluded as much, so maybe. If not for Miles, for the Empire Grill itself? Unlikely, since the old woman hadn't set foot in its shabby premises in 20 years. The other possibility, which Miles kept returning to, was the old woman's fondness for Miles's mother, who had worked for Mrs. Whiting until she fell ill. So again, maybe.
Reason with her, David urged him. Tell her people won't eat spicy Mexican and Asian food without beer, and they like wine with Italian.
I'll try, Miles said. But don't get your hopes up. She's not stupid, but for some reason she doesn't like change. Maybe it's just old age. Maybe she doesn't want to be bothered. Anyway, it's her business.
David pondered this obvious truth while a Red Sox batter hit a towering fly ball that was caught on the warning track. Then, studying his empty club soda, as if trying to recollect why a man like himself would drink soda water instead of beer, he said, "Want to hear another idea?" No, was the simple truth. It had been a long day, and Miles was too tired and dispirited by his conversation with Janine to think.
Sure, he said.
What?
Go talk to your mother-in-law.
B? Why?
Think about it, Miles. It makes sense.
It's a thought, Miles said.
Janine's mother owned not just the dying tavern Callahan's, but the building in which the tavern was housed, which meant that Mrs. Whiting, if she felt betrayed and decided to be vindictive, would have little recourse. No, there was no need for David to explain his thinking here. If Mrs. Whiting didn't want to spring for a liquor license and give them a fighting chance, move the whole kit and caboodle across town. B's place was bigger, too, which meant they'd have room to grow.
You'd be doing B a favor. She's going under by degrees.
You could save her and yourself at the same time.
I don't have the money to buy her place, David.
Offer to go partners. She provides the liquor license, you provide the food service. And what do I do when you leave? Am I going somewhere?
Well?
Don't well me, Miles.
You get bored with things and then you split.
I don't mean that as a criticism. There's no reason you shouldn't.
You don't have a family.
I just don't have the luxury, is all.
So you're saying I'm the reason you won't consider B's place?
I'm not saying I won't consider it, Miles said. I admit it's a thought.
I wish you wouldn't say it like that, David told him. It sounds dead already.
Miles didn't respond right away, not until he could speak without irritation. When the last Red Sox batter of the inning finally struck out with men on first and third, Miles said,
I owe her, David.
Owe who?
Mrs. Whiting. Isn't that who we were talking about? Maybe Janine and Tick and I haven't had a terribly prosperous life, but it hasn't been bad either. The restaurant has struggled, obviously, and God knows we've struggled right along with it. But we've kept our heads above water. And that's more than you can say for a lot of people around here. Mrs. Whiting could have closed the place down years ago, and where would that have left us? You want me to thumb my nose at her? And there's something else, too. I was away at college for 3 years, and every time I really needed money, Mom sent it. Where do you think Mom found $500 every semester for books and fees?
David considered this.
You think it was from Mrs. Whiting?
She didn't get it from Max. Who else was there?
I don't know, David admitted. But at least we're finally talking about the right person.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means when you said you owed her, that's who I thought you were talking about, Mom. If you were saying you owed her, that would have made some sense.
I don't need you to tell me how much I owe her, David.
Yeah?
Well, there's only one way to pay off that debt, big brother. And I'm sorry, but you do need reminding about the way things were. Mom never wanted you to come back. Your getting out of here was her life's work. You know that better than I do. If she borrowed money from Mrs. Whiting, you can bet she paid it back in full. Services rendered. She practically raised that woman's daughter. And if she knew you'd ended up 42 and running the Empire Grill, she'd turn over in her grave.
Miles rubbed his temples with his thumbs, feeling the first aura of a headache coming on.
I'm sure you're right that she'd be disappointed, he conceded, knowing too that disappointed was too lame a word for it. Broken-hearted was more like it.
No doubt I've shamed her. I feel like I have, believe me. But the one thing I don't think I'd have to explain to Grace Roby is that a kid comes first. Maybe I was wrong to come back, but I've got Tick now, and I can't put her in jeopardy. I won't.
And you imagine I would? You think I'd advise you to?
Isn't that what you're doing? Last week you were all for that bookstore I can't afford on Martha's Vineyard. Now you want me to make Mrs. Whiting my enemy by going into business with B. Have you ever looked at that kitchen? Do you have any idea how much fixing it up would cost?
Between us, we could... Miles couldn't listen.
David, if you want to go into business with B, then go. I give you my blessing.
His brother nodded slowly, as if this whole conversation had already taken place numerous times, and there were just one or two minor details he'd failed to memorize.
All right, he said finally. Since I've already pissed you off, I'll try this one more time and then give up. I know you've got Tick, Miles, and I know you're in a tight spot. In fact, I'm even more worried about the spot you're in than you are, because it's worse than you think. What I'm trying to say is that it isn't going to get any better. That woman's got you on a treadmill, Miles. You're running so hard all the time just to keep up that you can't see it. It's what Mom feared. It's what she knew would happen if you...
Tell me something, Miles interrupted. Why do you hate Mrs. Whiting so much?
Look, he said, it's not a question of hating her. You think she'll give you the restaurant like she promised, and then you'll sell it and get out, right?
When Miles didn't say anything, he continued. Except Mrs. Whiting isn't dying, Miles. You know what she's doing instead? She's living.
in Italy for a month when it suits her, in Florida during the winter, Santa Fe in the late spring. You're the one that's dying, Miles, a day at a time. Do you have any idea how old Mrs. Whiting's mother was when she died?
None, Miles confessed.
That's because she's still alive, David told him. She's in a nursing home in Fairhaven in her 90s. If Mrs. Whiting lives that long, you'll be 65 when you inherit the grill. That's if she gives it to you. And that's not even the worst part, Miles. You claim you're sticking it out for Tick. But do you know what that kid's gonna be if you aren't careful? She'll be the next manager of the Empire Grill.
Over my dead body, Miles said. His brother got to his feet and smiled, clearly having seen this coming.
Good. Now we've come full circle. That's what Mom always said about you. David tossed his empty soda bottle into the trash can by the door.
Look, I'm sorry I said anything. I should go home. I already know how this is going to end. For a moment, Miles thought that he was referring to their discussion, but then he realized that David probably meant the ball game. The Sox held a slender one-run lead in the seventh, and history, both recent and not so recent, suggested it wouldn't hold up. September was a bad month for New England baseball fans. You could spend most of it searching in vain for reasons you were so optimistic back in April. Next April was when you'd remember them.
When's Buster coming back? David wondered, referring to the grill's other fry cook, who'd commenced his bender the day Miles returned from Martha's Vineyard. Miles doubted his brother really cared about Buster. David was just anxious that they not part angry. His question was designed to restore the usual equilibrium.
I'll see if I can hunt him down tomorrow.
We're going to need another waitress and busboy, too.
I know. I'll get on it.
Okay, David said, starting out, then stopping, one hand on the doorknob.
What was Janine all upset about tonight?
I don't know, Miles said, meeting his brother's eye. The simple truth?
Cold feet, probably.
David nodded. I should hope so. Given the man she intends to marry, she ought to be cold all the way up to her barrettes.
I don't think women wear those anymore, do they?
It had been so long since Miles had loosened a woman's hair that he'd lost track.
Funny thing, though, David said, still standing in the doorway.
Miles studied him, dead certain that what came next would not be funny in the least.
The two of you sitting there in that booth tonight looked more like lovers than you ever did when you were married.
Funny, Miles said sadly. That's hilarious.
Mrs. Whiting's refrain, he realized.
David was all the way down the back stairs when Miles remembered something and hurried after him. David was backing his pickup out of his space behind the restaurant, a complicated maneuver for a man with only one good arm, when Miles rapped on the window.
Listen, Miles began. Tell me to mind my own business.
Okay, I will, David promised.
Are you growing marijuana out there at the lake?
His brother snorted.
Why, Miles, do you want some?
Miles didn't see why this seemed so damn funny, but he let it go.
Jimmy Minty thinks you are, is the reason I mentioned it.
Jimmy Minty thinks?
Apparently.
Why tell you?
He characterized it as a friendly warning, since we're all old friends. I sort of told him to fuck off. I also told him I didn't think you were.
David nodded.
You see him. Tell him I said thanks for the tip.
When his brother started rolling the window back up, Miles rapped on it again.
You didn't answer my question, he said. Are you growing marijuana out there?
David smiled.
Mind your own business.
You always talk about Mom as if I was the only one she had plans for. That's not true, you know.
David nodded.
I know exactly what she wanted me to do, because she told me before she died.
Something in Miles sensed a trap, but since it was his brother who'd said it, he decided to walk right in.
What was that?
Look after your brother, David said, backing out.
Chapter 7. How's that just came in?
Max Roby wanted to know when he felt the air change in the tavern. Sitting at the far end of the bar, he heard the front door swing shut with a dull thud. Whoever it was had stopped at the cigarette machine, a promising sign. Max leaned back on his stool, squinting across the dark room, trying to make out who it was. Since he'd turned 70, his eyes weren't as good as they used to be. Fortunately, he could still climb like a monkey.
It's Horace Weymouth, Bemejeski told him from behind the bar. Leave him alone.
B was just now pondering whether to close Callahan's for the night. It was going on midnight, and her only customer was Max Roby, who you couldn't really call a customer because he perpetually hovered at his $100 credit limit. Truth be told, most of B's customers were the same. They paid on their tabs by 10 or 20 bucks in the afternoon, then drink them back up to 100 by closing time. Unless she got lucky and one of them handed her a 20 and keeled over on the spot, every goddamn one of these deadbeats was going to die owing her $100. Even the stiff that had handed her the 20 would owe her 80. About the only trade Callahan's got anymore was from the Empire Towers, the subsidized senior citizens' housing facility down the block. First of the month, after they got their checks, the geezers would stream in. They'd drink old fashions and sidecars for a few days, but by the 10th or so, they'd have blown their booze allotment, and B wouldn't see any of them again until the 1st, except for Max Roby. He also lived over at the Towers, but he turned up regardless. At least the geezers didn't start fights, she told herself. Again, except for Max Roby. In fact, B told him now, suspecting that her previous instructions might be interpreted too narrowly, leave everybody alone.
Invite him down here, Max suggested. I could use some company.
B glared at him. What'd I just say?
How's that bothering anybody? I like Horace.
Me too, B said, studying him in the entryway, hunched over the cigarette machine, madly pulling at the levers now. He'd clearly abandoned his own brand for whatever the machine might deign to give him. Which is why I told you to leave him alone. A man ought to be able to come in here without you bumming cigarettes and draft beers. Out in the entryway, the machine surrendered a pack of some brand or other, which Horace bent down to scoop out of the trough. When he raised up again and turned toward the bar, he caught sight of Max, the only customer seated at the far end, where B always parked him because he smelled rancid and was a pain in the ass. This sight occasioned a small hitch in Horace's giddy-up, a split second's hesitation, during which a man might consider his options, like leaving. Other men had been known to turn promptly on their heels upon spying Max, but all his life, Horace had been victimized by his own good manners. A reporter for the Empire Gazette for going on 30 years, he'd seen humanity from every angle. Most people, he concluded, were selfish, greedy, unprincipled, venal, utterly irredeemable shit-eaters. But he'd also observed that these same people were highly sensitive to criticism. Max Roby was an exception. But Horace nonetheless couldn't bring himself to hurt the man's feelings, which meant he also couldn't plop down at the opposite end of the bar. That strategy wouldn't work anyway, since the exact same conversation would ensue, with Max shouting it.
What did he give you this time?
Max said, in an idly curious tone, when Horace slid onto a nearby stool, leaving one between them as a buffer zone, however inadequate. Horace tried to imagine the situation whereby someone would come in and fill that vacancy. It'd have to be a stranger, a blind stranger. No sense of smell, either.
Chesterfield, Horace said, examining the pack before placing it on the bar alongside a $20 bill.
B poured him a draft and slid an ashtray in front of him, leaving the 20 where it was for now.
You want one, Max? Sure, he said, leaning over to snatch the pack, then deftly peeling off its slender ribbon, thumbing up its flip-top, discarding the foil and removing two cigarettes. Horace noted that Max had taken two, not one, but said nothing, just as Max had known he wouldn't.
"You might as well draw one for my friend here," he told B. "He's got that thirsty look."
B did not approve of Horace's generosity, but she complied with his request. "Working late?" she asked. Horace nodded. Tonight had been a beaut. For starters, he'd had to cover the school board meeting in Fairhaven, one of his least favorite assignments. This one had progressed rapidly from civil to uncivil to angry to plain insulting, stopping just short of fisticuffs. Then, on the way home, his car had broken down on a seldom-used back road out by the old landfill. There was only one house within a radius of about a mile, and Horace, hoping to use the phone to call for a tow, had walked up the long dirt driveway, and there, around back of the dark old house, had secretly witnessed something that had rattled him to the core. Something that went far beyond the selfish, greedy, unprincipled, venal, utterly irredeemable shit-eating behavior he was used to, and sent him stealing back out to the road, as if he himself, and not that sad, alarming boy, had been the guilty party. As he walked nearly 3 miles into town, what he'd witnessed was with him every step, and it made him glad of companionship now, even if one of his companions was Max Roby.
"You should get that thing removed," Max suggested, glancing at the fibroid cyst on Horace's forehead.
"What thing?" Horace said, his standard reply to such comments, which were more frequent than anyone would imagine.
"I'm always afraid it'll explode when I'm talking to you," Max said, draining half of his beer in one sudden motion.
It hadn't been Max's intention to gulp so much, but he'd been perched there on his bar stool dry for a hell of a while. A bar could become a desert when you were broke, its beer spigots a mirage. When you finally arrived at the oasis, you could tell yourself not to drink too deeply, but a body parched so long by the desert sand has its own needs, its own devices. And Max was just glad his body hadn't demanded the whole glass Horace had bought him. The idea now was to be patient and adjust himself to the pace of the man he hoped to continue drinking with. If he tried to push Horace by draining his own glass too quickly, the other man would feel pressured and leave. Then Max would be smack dab in the middle of the desert again. Horace had a car, and if so motivated, could just get up and walk out and drive to the lamplighter, a place where Max wasn't welcome, even if he had a way to get there, which he didn't, unless he walked or hitched. The first he refused to do, the second he never had much luck at, owing, if his son Miles was to be believed, to his personal appearance. This lack of transportation was beginning to get Max down. They'd taken away his license 3 years ago when he ran over the mayor's daughter's dog, strengthening his conviction that a man's prospects in life were determined by luck and politics. In a town overrun by mangy curs, it was the damn unlucky man who ran over a purebred fox terrier owned by the mayor's 8-year-old brat. Any other victim wouldn't have had the political wherewithal to pull Max's records and get him declared a public menace. A luckier fellow would have run over a stray mutt and been proclaimed a public benefactor. They'd have probably given him a job at the Humane Society, where they gave animals a week, two at the outside, to get claimed, after which they got the needle. No, Max knew all about luck. He knew, for instance, what bad luck was always followed by. Worse luck. Not a month after losing his license, he'd left Callahan's around closing time one night, and nodding off at the wheel, had driven into a ditch where the car's frame snapped in half, leaving him no choice but to walk back to Callahan's and report the vehicle stolen, also leaving him in the condition in which he now found himself, a man not only without a license, which was inconvenience enough, but also without a car, which made it a full-blown dilemma. An old man without wheels was a pitiful thing. People could get up and leave, and you couldn't follow them. And they knew you couldn't, which meant they were more likely to do just that. Winter was just around the corner, too. High time he got himself down to Key West, where you didn't freeze your ass off, and you didn't need a car, since the bars were all lined up, one right after another, and almost everybody either walked or rode bicycles. Max sighed, staring at his now empty glass, considering the unfairness of it all.
"What would it cost you to have it removed?" he wondered out loud, touching his forehead where his own cyst, if he'd had one, would have been located. Horace was sitting there nursing his beer, which made Max even more resentful. "A couple $100?"
Horace shrugged, exchanging a glance with B, who was getting ready to give Max the boot, he could tell.
"Hard to say." Max stifled a bitter laugh. "Why? You never looked into it?"
"Never did."
"I sure would have," Max said. "That son of a bitch was growing out of the middle of my forehead. I'd have looked into it pronto."
"I think it might be the source of my intelligence," Horace told him, winking at B. "What if I let somebody cut it off and then discovered it was responsible for all my best ideas?"
"That's something Max wouldn't have to worry about," B said, "not having a brain." Max treated this insult the way he treated all insults, by pushing his glass forward for a refill. In his experience, after insulting you, people generally felt guilty. It occurred to them that maybe they were selling you short. They wondered if they could do something to make it up to you. This impulse never lasted long, though, so you had to take advantage swiftly. Max had been offering B opportunities to insult him all night long, but until this very moment she'd resisted, which meant she hadn't owed him anything, and his glass had remained dry. Now she had no choice but to fill it, and grudgingly slide it back in front of him. This time he drained off only a third, which put him in stride with Horace, right where he wanted to be.
"You ever been to Florida?" Max asked.
"Once," Horace admitted.
"Back when I was married." "Before that thing started growing out of your forehead, I bet," Max said, abruptly scooting off his stool. "I gotta pee."
B sighed when the men's room door swung shut behind him. "You want me to run his sorry ass?" The only reason she hadn't 86 the old fart before now was out of affection for his son Miles, who was about the nicest, saddest man in all of Empire Falls. A man so good-natured that not even being married to her daughter, Janine, had ruined him. What Janine was thinking in trading in a man like Miles for a little banty rooster like Walt Como defied imagination, or at least Bee's imagination. True, Miles wasn't sexy and never had been, unless you considered kindness sexy, which Bee always had. Granted, there were men you wanted to sleep with, some men because they got you all hot and bothered, but others, like Miles, you just kind of wanted to do something nice for because they were decent and deserved it, and you knew they'd be appreciative and wouldn't hold it against you for maybe not being so damn beautiful yourself. Bea had tried to explain this to her daughter once, but it had come out all wrong, and Janine had misunderstood completely. "That's mercy fucking," she'd said. And B hadn't bothered to argue because her daughter lately considered herself an authority on all matters sexual. In fact, she'd grown tiresome on the subject, especially since B was just as happy to have that part of her life safely behind her. Saying goodbye to sex was like waking up from a delirium, a tropical fever, into a world of cool, gentle breezes. Good riddance. Miles, though, was the sort of man you could love without completely losing your self-respect, which couldn't be said for most of them, and certainly not for Walt Como.
"Nah, leave him be," Horace said. "Max just says what he thinks whenever he thinks it. It's the people who always pause to consider that I worry about."
"He's an asshole, is what he is."
"Well, yeah, there is that," Horace admitted, as the men's room door swung open to announce Max's return.
That a man could relieve himself so quickly didn't seem possible, and both Horace and B regarded him curiously as he slid nimbly back onto his stool. The front of his trousers bore traces of urinary haste.
"Jesus," B said, shaking her head in disgust. "You're a foul, vulgar old man. When you're done, give it a shake, at least."
"You ever been to the Keys?"
Max asked Horace, ignoring B entirely.
Never. Where were you in Florida?
Orlando.
You like Key West, Max assured him. Hemingway lived there.
Horace took a swig of beer and watched Max do the same. The Hemingway tidbit was interesting, coming from this particular old man.
Hemingway.
Right,
Max said, glad to see he'd set the hook properly. Horace, he knew, wrote for the newspaper and might be drawn to another writer the way a normal person might be drawn to beer and warm weather.
Hell of a guy.
You met him?
Everything's named after him down there. Hemingway this, Papa that. His pals called him Papa, you know.
What I asked was, did you ever meet him?
Who knows?
Horace couldn't help but chuckle.
What do you mean?
I mean, who the hell knows? I drank a lot of beer down there over the years. He could have been sitting on the next stool over one of those nights. How would I know?
I bet there was at least one stool between you, B said.
When did you start going down there? Horace asked.
Winter of 69.
Then you didn't sit next to Hemingway, Horace said. He killed himself in 61.
Max tried to remember if he'd heard this. He was pretty sure he already knew Hemingway was dead. He'd snuck into the writer's house with a group of tourists, 20 years ago, and he seemed to recall there'd been some mention of Hemingway being dead. He wasn't home, at any rate. What had impressed Max most about the house was all those cats, most of which had an extra digit that looked like a thumb on their front paws. He didn't think a thumb was all that attractive on a cat, though these old toms looked like they could pick up a glass of beer just like a human being did, the way that damn thumb curled around. According to the tour guide, the great writer's cats were much revered. At any rate, they sure had the run of the place. That was what Max liked about the Keys, that pretty damn near everything was tolerated, including Max himself, whose decrepit state, much derided up north, was considered down there the natural, indeed the inevitable, state of man. In Key West, Max was often taken for a local, the ones they called conks, and such misguided tourists would happily buy him drinks. Hemingway, being famous, probably never had to buy his own drinks, which raised an interesting question.
Killed himself? Why would he do that?
Probably just woke up one morning and felt the futility of the whole thing, Horace guessed.
What futility?
Horace studied his companion.
People have been known to come to that conclusion about their existence, you know. Hell, not all that long ago, the richest man in Central Maine blew his brains out right here in Empire Falls.
C.B. Whiting, he meant. Charles Beaumont. Charlie.
23 years ago March, Max said, aware as soon as the words were out of his mouth that both Horace and B were staring at him.
How in the world would you know that? B said. Max shrugged, as if to suggest that people had a right to know anything they wanted to, this being a free country. Anyway, C.B. Whiting's killing himself wasn't even the weird part, to Max's way of thinking, and he thought about it plenty during the past 2+ decades. No, the weird part was that Whiting had taken the time and trouble to come all the way back to Empire Falls when he could have just shot himself in Mexico, where he was living at the time. On the other hand, Max allowed, draining the rest of his beer, a man who decided to shoot himself in the head probably wasn't thinking too clearly in the first place. His glass empty again, Max looked over at Horace's, which was still half full. Max supposed he could try pushing his glass at B again, but he knew it wouldn't do any good. You only got one insult beer per night with B, who afterward could insult you for free. Talk about futility.
You and I should go down there someday, he suggested to Horace. The women all walk around half naked. They don't mind if you look, either. There's this one bar down there where the girls take off their bras and panties and nail them to the ceiling. You should see it. I'm free anytime you want to go.
I don't think so, Horace said,
pushing the 20 toward B and signaling to Max Roby his intention to make this a one-draft night.
I might get depressed, shoot myself in the head.
Max saw the gesture and was gravely disappointed. Miffed, too.
Try to miss that thing on your head, he advised. What a hell of a mess that would make.
After Horace left, Max downed the last swallow of beer in the other man's glass, and then, annoyed with himself for indulging morbid thoughts, gave himself over to the problem of whom he might entice to accompany him southward. The ideal candidate would own a car and not expect much in the way of gas money from Max. Once in Florida, things would be easier. Once he found a place to stay, he'd get somebody at the Empire Towers to send him his government check at the first of each month. It worried Max a little, the way money evaporated in the Keys. Sun, Max supposed, shining all the while, making you sweat, and it was the sweating made you thirsty. Beer was more expensive down in Florida, but Max much preferred how they served it, with a fresh slice of lime wedged right into the mouth of the sweating bottle. If a man wasn't careful, he could drink the bottom right out of a Social Security check by mid-month, and then he'd have to scam like mad till the first. What Max needed was an honest-to-God live one. Somebody with a little dough who was looking to have a good time and didn't know how. Horace, whom Max had initially cast in this role, wasn't right, the more he thought about it. Just as well he hadn't warmed to the idea. He couldn't imagine trying to explain that damn knot on Horace's forehead everywhere they went. Women especially would want to know the story of that purple, veiny son of a bitch at least enough to be reassured it wasn't contagious. 10 years ago, there were any number of people Max might have talked into making the trip, but the years had taken a heavy toll. Many of Max's favorites were dead. Others were in nursing homes. Still others had just gotten too damn old in spirit, which Max flatly couldn't understand. He'd just turned 70, he felt about 15, and had all his life. A woman might make an interesting traveling companion, and here again, 10 years ago, he wouldn't have had to go looking very far. In a town like Empire Falls, somebody's wife was always ready and willing to fly the coop if approached in the right way, and Max found himself wondering what in hell had happened to all the good women. Most of the old ones had got religion, and the younger ones could do better than Max Roby and let him know as much, in case he had any doubts. Which was also probably just as well. Women, generally speaking, had a lot of needs. They needed to stay in nice places, and needed to pee every time you turned around, and needed to keep you abreast of what they were thinking pretty much constantly. But they didn't understand money needs at all, like when you ran out. Then there was the philosophical issue of why you'd even want to bring one someplace when there'd be plenty of women already there when you arrived. Coles to Newcastle, if you thought about it. Max liked the women in the Keys. Life seemed to have made them realists, not dreamers. Also, they seemed to grasp instinctively how men like Max ended up men like Max, and not to hold it against them.
"Wake up, Max," B said, interrupting his reverie, and for a moment he concluded that she'd been eavesdropping on his thoughts. On the TV above the bar, he was surprised to see that the ball game had been replaced by the post-game show. Yet again, the Sox were losers.
"Go home," B told him.
"What time is it?"
Max asked, squinting at the clock positioned halfway down the bar. If there was one thing he hated, it was a bar that closed early.
1 o'clock, B told him. You've been asleep for an hour.
I wasn't asleep, I was thinking, Max said.
Yeah? Well, you're the only man I know who snores when he's thinking.
She switched the TV off, leaving Max just enough light to make his way to the front door.
You drank those last two beers too fast, old man. They did you in.
I drank them just right, he assured her.
There was only one wrong way to drink beer, in Max's opinion, and that was the way Horace had done it, letting it get warm and then leaving some of it in the glass. When Max left beer, it was in the urinal.
I gotta pee, he said, heading for the gents.
Then do it in your own place, B told him,
steering him toward the front, hard and heartless woman that she was. You only lived down the block. True, perhaps, but down the block was too far. The Empire Towers were set way back off the street. Max's studio apartment was on the 6th floor, and the elevator was slow. He knew from experience that when it was most urgent that he do so, he sometimes couldn't slip his key into the lock cleanly. Fortunately, the alley alongside Callahan's was unoccupied, and Max used the brick wall of the tavern to excellent advantage. When he finished, he felt energized, suddenly unwilling to call it a night. A fine, almost fog-like mist hung in the air, and Max decided it was a good night for a stroll. So he set off across town, the whole of Empire Falls rolled up and quiet. He didn't run across a single car or pedestrian the entire way to the cemetery, where he located, without difficulty, even in the dark, his wife's grave. He stood at the foot of it without moving for so long that anyone passing by on the other side of the tall, wrought iron fence could fairly have concluded he was a statue. Gradually, the gentle mist turned to rain, and still the old man, hatless, remained at the foot of the stone marked Grace Roby, the stone his sons had placed there when she died, when Max was down in the Florida Keys, consorting with a different sort of woman entirely, the sort he should have found right at the beginning. Strange that he should feel so content and peaceful in Grace's company now, since he never had when she was alive, so full of hopes and dreams it hurt to look at her. Max catnapped on his feet a while longer, then woke up feeling refreshed, if soaked through. Also, he had to pee again, which necessity he announced loud to his wife and the other silent sleepers. One of these was Charles Beaumont Whiting, who, like the great Hemingway, if Horace was to be believed, must have woken up one morning impressed by the futility of his existence, a feeling Max doubted he'd ever understand. Life was a lot of things, including disappointing from time to time, but still. Atop C.B. Whiting's nearby grave, his widow had placed a monument to ensure that her husband stayed right where he was. Max unzipped there and reflected that a good, long, soul-cleansing pee was something many men his age were incapable of. Once they turned 70, they became leaky faucets with slow, incessant drips. Not Max, whose prostate ought to be willed to science. "I hope you're good and thirsty," he told old Charlie, and then let go. Only when he was finished did he look up and notice, perched atop the monument, a stone cat. Odd that he hadn't noticed this on any of his previous homages to C.B. Whiting, of which there'd been many. The animal looked so lifelike that it gave Max a scare, though not as big as the one he would have gotten had he looked closer and seen it was breathing. Chapter 8. The summer Miles turned 9, he played second base for the Empire Paper Giants. One of the younger boys on the team, he spent most of the summer on the bench, watching the older boys, the fearless ones who stayed in front of ground balls no matter how hard they were hit. Coach LaSalle wouldn't put him in until the late innings, by which time the game was either won or lost, for which Miles was grateful, terrified that the team might lose because of him. When he did finally enter the game and the boys on the opposing team saw him loitering around second base with his too large glove and fearful expression, they'd turn around and bat left-handed, knowing that a ground ball in his direction was as good as a hit. All of which changed the last week in July, when Miles made a miraculous catch. Actually, he'd been daydreaming at his post when he heard the crack of the bat, and the ball was on him so fast he hadn't had time to duck out of the way, as was his custom. The ball hit his open glove so hard that it lodged in the webbing, spinning Miles completely around and landing him on the seat of his pants. Somehow the glove managed to stay on his hand and the ball in the glove.
"Look what I found," Coach LaSalle said when he trotted in, his tone not so much mean as pleased, and the backslapping congratulations of his teammates gave Miles heart.
Though to this point it had been a consistent source of humiliation, Miles purely loved the game of baseball, and he loved even more the idea that he might be an asset to the team instead of a liability. Having caught one ball by mistake, he saw no reason why he shouldn't start catching others on purpose. When his mother announced that they were going away for a week's vacation, Miles agreed only on the condition that he be allowed to bring his glove. Grace assured him there'd be no place to play on Martha's Vineyard, but he was determined to practice every day, even if only by throwing himself pop flies on the beach. Besides, his mother admitted she'd never been there herself, so Miles harbored a secret hope they'd be surprised by what they found there. To his way of thinking, if the island was full of rich people, as she claimed, there just might be baseball diamonds everywhere, more than enough for everyone who wanted to play. There were probably leagues set up just for boys like himself who were dragged away against their will at the worst possible moment on hastily conceived vacations. It turned out his mother was right, though, as Miles could tell from the deck of the ferry as they steamed into Vineyard Haven. But it was clear that his mother hadn't known exactly what to expect either, because when they docked and she got a good look at the crowds of well-dressed people in expensive-looking cars who'd come to meet the ferry, Miles saw her hand steal to her mouth, as it did when she was afraid or became aware that she'd made a mistake. In fact, she looked like she was considering just remaining there at the railing of the ferry and returning home without even disembarking. It was Miles who spotted the man on the wharf below, waving either at them or at someone near them. Miles had never seen him before, but when he pointed the man out, his mother waved back. "How do you know us?" she asked, when the man who introduced himself as Mr. Miller met them at the bottom of the ramp.
"This fella here was the tip-off," Mr. Miller said, smiling at him. "Ball player, eh?"
Now it was Miles' turn to admire the man's apparent prescience, until he remembered he was wearing his mitt, which the soft sea air and salt spray on the lower deck of the ferry seemed actually to be softening. For the first time since his father had given it to him, he was able to close it with one hand.
"We sure appreciate your making an exception for us," his mother said, as Mr. Miller gathered their bags from the train of luggage bins being offloaded from the ferry. He seemed to know which ones were theirs without asking, which made Miles wonder if this was because they were shabbier than the others.
"I know you don't normally take children."
"Well," Mr. Miller said, loading the suitcases into the back of a station wagon whose engine had been left running, "you had a friend in high places." Then he quickly added, "Besides, this young fella's mostly grown up anyhow, right?"
It happened they were staying on the other side of the island, near a fishing village, and when Mr. Miller pulled the station wagon into the long, narrow drive that led to Summer House, which sat on a bluff overlooking the ocean, the fear Miles had noticed before on the ferry crept again.